This panel discussion at the 10th Annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference, put on by the Migration Policy Institute and other organizations, focuses on a new reality at the border, assessing current conditions and considerations for future policy. The moderator is Andrew Schoenholtz, Director of Georgetown Law's Human Rights Institute and Deputy Director of Georgetown University's Institute for the Study of International Migration. The speakers are Mike Fisher, Chief of the U.S. Border Patrol, Edward Alden, who is the Bernard Schwartz Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Fernando Garcia, Executive Director of the Border Network for Human Rights. Here now, Andrew Schoenholtz.
Border, which of course is what is the government, any government, is responsible for defending and protecting. But I also think of the border in the sense that it plays a symbolic role in the imagination of citizens in every country of the world, actually, but in ours as well. And I often think that it's that symbolic power of the border that often matters politically, as well as, of course, the territorial border. But today we're not here to talk particularly about the symbols and the politics per se. We really have experts here to help us assess how the resources are being used, what the policies and practices that Congress has funded and is considering funding for, and what the executive priorities are, as well as how the border communities are affected by these. So our three experts will begin with the Chief of the Border Patrol, Mike Fisher. We'll then proceed to Ted Alden, who's been writing in the immigration area for a number of years. He's actually an expert on competitiveness, economic competitiveness, and he just told me one of the books he's working on right now really is that larger subject, but of course immigration is a part of that, and so he has studied border issues in relation to economic competitiveness and other aspects of us. And Ted is at the Council for Foreign Relations. He'll talk about his analyses of border issues, and then directly from the border communities to help us understand what's actually going on in those communities, our colleague Fernando Garcia, who heads up a major human rights organization on the border. So, without further ado, Chief Fisher.
Thank you, sir. And first of all, I want to thank the audience for the invitation and certainly the commissioner. Just one small point of clarification. I'm not an expert. I consider myself a Border Patrol agent for about 26 and a half years. And all that means is that I have a perspective based on my career. It's not right. It's not wrong. And I look forward to your questions. What I thought I'd do just kind of set the stage is talk a little bit about the organization, the staffing, some of just the frame when we hear the Border Patrol, because as the panel was set up and looking at, you know, the discussion points, there has been quite a bit of change in the border environment. So I want to talk a little bit about that and then talk about, you know, what our general current operations are, not to make it a strategic brief necessarily, but just to kind of frame some of the things that the leadership within the organization is thinking may help, you know, frame some of the questions for you later. So let's first talk a little bit about the organization, the Border Patrol. We are one of the three operational components within U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which is the agency within, obviously, the Department of Homeland Security. Now, within the Customs and Border Protection, commonly referred to as CBP, you have the Border Patrol that is works between and has jurisdiction between the ports of entry. You have the Office of Field Operations. They wear the blue uniforms at the air, land, and sea ports of entry. Then you have the Air and Marine Branch, which is the largest civilian law enforcement air force in the world, and they support a wide variety of DHS operations. The large extent is providing support to Border Patrol agents on the ground. So when you look at, we're at 21,370 agents, and the reason why I know exactly what that number is, a few years ago, the appropriations, when they signed the legislation funding CBP, that number is a mandatory minimum staffing level, and that has carried on over the last few years and currently holds true during the current continuing resolution, which means at any given time we have to maintain 21,370 agents. It's manageable because when you look at our attrition, it's about 3%. So we generally, so the good news is we're always hiring, and I always take the opportunity for a recruitment pitch. So if people were looking for employment,
Looking for law students too, Chief?
Yes. Well, that's actually a good segue. So let me talk a little bit about the, you know, typical Border Patrol agent. And this is just, you know, looking at demographically where we sit as an organization. So the typical Border Patrol agent is about 34 years old. He or she would have approximately 7 years in service with us. We have about, on average, they would have about a year of college. And many of them continue on through their education while they're in the Border Patrol. So certainly not a limiting factor. And interestingly enough, what has changed from probably the first 20 years of my career and what has changed within the last, say, 5 years or so is one out of three of those agents had prior military service. And so when you look at the framework of the organization, that's what makes up the Border Patrol today. Let me talk a little bit about the changing environment, which was really one of the first three key pieces. About 3 years ago, when we were looking at the border, we were looking at our strategy, and there was a decision that was made to basically change the direction in terms of our strategy. And the reason for that was threefold. First and foremost, the environment in which we operate had changed. And if we want to get into, well, what does that really mean in terms of our perspective, we can certainly do that, and I can give you some specific examples on that. Not the least of which was the level of flow into this country over the course of the last 5 to 10 years. And the fact that when you look at, you know, shifting, whether it's apprehensions or the number of people, a really important distinction, by the way, because that too has shifted over the course of the few years. So that environment has changed. When you look at apprehensions, and by the way, I don't talk a lot about apprehensions only as a prelude to things like recidivism and average apprehensions per recidivist and all the metrics that that support the strategic objectives. What a lot of people don't know is the Border Patrol agents last year apprehended approximately 430,000 apprehensions, right, which was about 330,000 people, but that represented 144 different countries. And so a lot of people, when they look at the numbers and the job that we do and the work that we do in terms of our primary mission, which is to reduce the likelihood of terrorist attacks to this country and certainly weapons of mass effect coming in, while at the same time providing a level of safety and security for the community in which we serve, it's a lot of activity. The second thing that we started thinking about, and obviously over the post 9/11 environment, our capabilities have really been enhanced, both in terms of technology, and it's not just the quantity in terms of night vision goggles and thermal scope systems, but really it's the quality of type of the technology. What you generally see in terms of, you know, Moore's Law playing out in terms of iPhones and everything else, we start seeing the same replication in terms of our ability to really provide broader situational awareness and provide the tools that are necessary for Border Patrol agents to go out and do that mission and be safe and secure. And it really wasn't a big stretch. I mean, 26 and a half years doesn't sound like a long time, and really I keep learning every day. But it wasn't too long ago when I came into the Border Patrol that I was issued a flashlight. I had to buy my own batteries, by the way. And then we had to share one radio between four of us on a shift. And so when you fast forward to what we have today in terms of that level of technology, it's really difficult, which if I was a Border Patrol agent coming in the ranks today, I probably wouldn't survive. I mean, the Spanish was hard enough in getting past the 6.5 and 10.5 month test, but the level of technology that these agents now have to become proficient with is just extraordinary. And third and last but not least is really the convergence of illicit networks. A lot of people, you know, when you look at the environment, there's been a lot of change. It's been both in terms of not just the flow, but those criminal networks that have morphed over the years. And when I talk about illicit networks, I mean just that. When you look at the structures and those people that really are setting up these businesses to make money, whether the commodity is smuggling narcotics, and you can pick, you know, the choice of those narcotics, the human smuggling, the human trafficking, those organizations have changed. So much so that in July of 2011, the administration put out, and this is part of the National Security Staff's work, had really put out the strategy to combat transnational organized crime. If you haven't had the opportunity to look at it, it's somewhat of a lengthy document, but really I think the executive summary sums it up. And so we had to start thinking about our border environment differently given the convergence of those illicit networks. Talk about current operations and then I'll conclude. Our current operations right now are really focused in primarily two areas, that being Arizona and South Texas. And I really should have said it the other way, South Texas and then Arizona, which over the course of the past 10 years, and I was able to hear the tail remarks from Senator McCain, and really for the longest time, starting about 1999, when the shift of the activity from San Diego moved into that particular corridor, the vast majority, up to about 52% at one point, of all entries along the southwest border occurred in that 260 miles of border. That is no longer the case, and that actually shifted this past year, FY13, when you look at the level of activity and flows. What also has changed in terms of that flow is generally about 5 years ago, you would have about 20% of the people that we apprehended coming in between the ports of entry were from some other country than Mexico. And when you look at the demographic shift as of this 2013 reporting cycle, it's about a 60-40 shift. So right now about 40% of the individuals that we apprehend are from other countries other than Mexico. And when you look at the concentration and the increase, and the senator, you know, talked a little bit about the increase of apprehensions compared to last year, that really has manifested itself specifically in an area of Rio Grande Valley, where right now and throughout last year, as it's been climbing, 70% of the individuals that they apprehend in South Texas are from some other country than Mexico. There's been huge demographic shifts in terms of the individuals that we encounter, in terms of ages and where they're coming from, all across Central and South America, and really predominantly within the hemisphere. And so when we look at border security, we talk in terms of trying to reduce risk. You know, this whole notion about, well, what does a secure border really mean? What does it look like? And I know the commissioner's been on some panels over the last couple of years, and there's still a debate, at least at current count, in terms of what that end state is supposed to look like. And so what we did is we kind of marched forward in our strategy and in our implementation, and we defined that within the organization, certainly open for debate. And part of what we describe as secure border is being low risk. And we can talk about what that means and how we measure that and how that's transformed in terms of how we approach and making that state of the border assessment. And if you notice, I mentioned it as a state of the border, which suggests a continuing state that is going to fluctuate based on threats and vulnerabilities. Because what's been teed up over the course of the last couple of years, and when I go up to the committees and people ask me and say, Chief, we want to know, is the border secure yet or not? That suggests an either-or proposition. And so at some point in time, there's going to be a magic assessment done either by me or by a group of individuals to say, yes, we have achieved that. And then to suggest somehow that's going to be a steady state and it's never going to change really hasn't, I think, really looked at the border as much as many of you in this audience have done. And again, thank you for the opportunity. I look forward to your discussions.
Thank you very much, Chief, for kicking us off. Ted?
Great, thanks. I'm privileged to follow the chief here, and I'll try to fill in a little bit of the history to flesh out a bit Chief Fisher's description of what's going on currently. I've got a couple of slides that just give you some of the numbers on this. We all know border control is obviously an enormously important part of the current debate over immigration reform. I mean, we've all heard the refrain going back to the 1986 IRCA that the previous panel discussed. You know, the theory at the time was we would do a one-time legalization that would solve the problem. Instead, as we all know, following the 1986 legislation, we had the biggest surge in illegal immigration in the history of the United States. And there were lots of reasons for that. Lack of border control was only one of them, but it was certainly a significant factor. And so we're continuing, you know, now even 25, almost 30 years later, to deal with the overhang of that. Lawmakers who say, well, you know, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you, and not willing to go down that road again. So the question, is the problem at the border still the same one as it was in 1986? And I have done a lot of work in recent years looking at different aspects of border control. I wrote a book that looked at what's happened in the air environment since 9/11. All 19 of the hijackers came to the United States on airplanes with legal visas, but enormous changes in that space since 9/11. And more recently, I've written numerous articles as well looking at developments in the land borders with Canada and with Mexico. A friend of mine, Brian Roberts, who was an economist working at DHS for many years, he and I in 2011 authored a piece in Foreign Affairs which asked exactly the chief's question, which is, what is a secure border? Why we don't know and how to find out. And then more recently, Brian and I teamed up with John Whitley, who was actually Brian's boss in DHS in the Program Analysis and Evaluation Division, to try to look at some of the metrics. How would we best assess progress in border security? We came out, since Don was hawking their wonderful report on enforcement, I'll do the same on this. We came out with a paper in May called Managing Illegal Immigration to the United States, How Effective is Enforcement, which tries to look at these questions. It's available on our website at CFR if you're interested. So my big argument here is that U.S. border control today looks nothing at all like it did in 1986. I wrote in my book that for most of its history, and this was still largely true in 1986, quote, the United States had only the loosest sort of border controls. Scrutiny of most visa applicants was cursory. Few checks were done on incoming airline passengers, and it was possible to walk freely across almost any portion of the more than 7,500 miles of land border with Mexico or Canada. None of these statements is even the slightest bit true today. And let me just run through a few of the highlights. As the chief mentioned, the increase in border patrol, agents in border patrol man hours. This is a measurement here of man hours on the top line and fencing on the bottom line. So we have the number of border patrol agents, 3,000 back in 1986. We're over 21,000 today. You can see, the number of hours, on the line fourfold from what it was back in the early 90s. Fencing technology deployed along much of the border. I mean, you can really see here in particular, I think a lot of people don't understand how steep that curve got after 2005. I mean, a lot of people think this was a reaction to 9/11. In fact, there really were two big periods of the buildup. One was the 1990s in California and Texas, and the other one was post-2005 as part of the Bush administration's effort to get immigration reform legislation. 25 years ago, it was pretty easy to slip across the border in any of the major urban areas, you know, Tijuana, San Diego, or El Paso, Juarez. That is simply not true today. It is difficult, dangerous, and expensive to cross the southern border illegally. At the legal ports of entry, very difficult to cross now, virtually impossible, without some kind of official tamper-proof document. So a passport or a passport card or a border crossing card. I mean, just by point of comparison, the so-called Millennium Bomber in 2000, Ahmed Rassam, who had tried to come down from Canada to carry out a plot to bomb the Los Angeles airport, he showed the customs, it wasn't called CBP at the time, but he showed the customs immigration inspector a Costco card. So that was his identity for trying to travel in the United States. Fortunately, she didn't accept it. And he was stopped at the border in Port Angeles out in my neck of the woods out on the West Coast. Visa checks are far more stringent. And non-visa travelers have to provide all their passport, other identifying information to the U.S. government in advance. Free travelers now checked against terrorist and criminal watch lists. Their travel histories are checked. Try to see if there's any red flags there that indicate possible involvement in terrorist activities. Most air travelers coming to the United States now are fingerprinted when they arrive at the airport. We started with two. We now take 10 fingerprints from everyone arriving, again, to double check on identity and also for potential ties to criminal or terrorist activity, because we have big databases in both the criminal world, the FBI, and in the Defense Department. And the United States now tracks departing passengers through their passport data. Increasingly, the U.S. government knows someone here on a visa has overstayed their visa. Now, we've all heard the figure that 40% of those here illegally originally came on a legal visa. The U.S. government is doing a much better job of tracking this. The Senate bill talks about creating a biometric exit, which is complicated, but perhaps doable, at least in the air environment. So it's no exaggeration that we've gone from having one of the more porous borders in the world to one of the most secure. Still possible, of course, to get in the United States illegally, and many people do it, but it's much, much harder than it used to be. Judging from the political rhetoric that still goes on in Congress today, most Americans simply do not understand this. They believe the border is still extremely porous. So let me just run through some of the metrics that sort of back up my case that the border now is not anything like what it was. So this slide number three, is measuring total border apprehension. So this is number of arrests per year. And the news here, obviously, is this tremendous downward slope in all three lines over the last decade. I like to do it state by state, though, because there's a story contained in this, which is if you want to understand why Senator McCain's state, Arizona, is the state that has been so much on the front line of the debate over illegal immigration, this graphic tells you. So you go back to the early 1990s, the mid-90s, when Doris was commissioner, the Texas and California were the big entry corridors. Obviously, the urban areas, easy. San Diego, Tijuana, El Paso, Juarez, Brentsville, Matamoros, those were the easy entry corridors. Well, the Border Patrol shut those down. You know, Operation Gatekeeper, California, Operation Hold the Line. In Texas, well, what happened? All of the unauthorized traffic moved into Arizona. That's that purple line that went way, way up by 2000, 2001. But the big story, steady downward since. The little blip at the end there is Texas, and I don't have the 13 data in here. I think that goes up even a little more in the 13 data. As the chief talked about, that's mostly non-Mexicans coming through that South Texas corridor. But that clearly is a pretty impressive measure of success. You get the same sort of results, not maybe quite as dramatic visually, but if you look at apprehension rates for illegal crossers, so that's the percentage of those trying to apprehend who, the percentage of those trying to cross illegally who are arrested by the Border Patrol. The research that we've got in this paper with Brian and John uses a variety of methods, survey data that's been collected for years, recidivist analysis, which is people making multiple attempts. They all show that the likelihood of someone getting caught has gone up significantly in the past two decades, probably at least to 50%, perhaps a bit higher from the low 30s in 1990. So again, significant improvement on that front. And then this last slide, which looks specifically at what we call the known flow data, which is the data that's been kept pretty scrupulously sector by sector in the Border Patrol over the last decade and a bit more. And what that data measures is, we can get into it if we want to. It's a little more optimistic than some of our other data, but what it measures, the Border Patrol knows the people they catch. They observe people who try to come into the country and then go back across the border into Mexico. Those are called turnbacks. And then they have evidence for people they miss, either visual sightings or what's called sign cutting, so evidence of people in the desert and other places. And CBP did a big service by releasing all this data to the GAO for a December 2012 report, which really has changed the debate over border control. You know, Senator McCain talked about this 90% effectiveness threshold. That's a goal that Congress may establish as part of this bill, that we want a situation on the border where 90% of those who try to cross are either arrested or they're forced to turn back. And as you can see, we're not that far from it in a lot of the key sectors. Again, Rio Grande Valley is where the challenges remain the biggest, and the chief would know a lot more about that. So I want to turn quickly to the issue of what should be done next, because we were asked on this panel to address that. And I would say there are really two broad approaches on the table as part of the legislation currently being considered by the Congress. One is embodied in the Senate bill, and particularly in the Corker-Hoven amendment, which was a last-minute political deal that came together to allow enough the Republican support to get the bill through the Senate. It continues what really has been, I would call, the resource-based approach of the last two decades. Border Patrol, you go back to this period in the 80s, early 90s, was clearly terribly under-resourced for the scale of its mission. This is just a measure of Border Patrol agents. You could use technology measures. You can use others. Big increases over the last two decades. Corcoran-Hoven just throws a lot more money at the problem. Says, okay, over the next 10 years, we're going to double the number of agents again. We're going to go from 21,000 to in the neighborhood of 40,000, even though there are, you know, parts of the borders, the chief will tell you, where they're not making a lot of arrests now because the traffic's way down. A lot of technology in that. A lot of it probably necessary. But again, it's a big resource base. Let's throw a lot more agents. Let's throw a lot more stuff at the problem and hope we get the results we want. $46 billion over 10 years. The other approach is embodied in the legislation that was passed unanimously, and I will say that again because it's stunning, unanimously by the House Homeland Security Committee, which takes what I would call a results-based approach. It sets a target for the administration, which is this 90% effectiveness number, and then asks the professionals, people in the Border Patrol, CBP, to lay out what they need to reach that goal. And we can certainly talk about the potential problems with the House approach, but I strongly believe that the focus on results rather than inputs is the right way to go. And I find it encouraging that Congress is now talking in more tangible terms about what a secure border actually means, rather than just complaining, oh my gosh, the border is insecure and therefore we can't do anything else on the immigration front. And again, I want to praise CBP and the Border Patrol, I think, who've played a very constructive role in the shift towards that approach. This is an administration that takes metrics seriously, and I think that's critical for making progress. Bill, as I said, passed the committee unanimously. We'll see where it goes. Mike McCall, the Texas Republican who chairs the committee, said yesterday, according to a Politico story, that he doesn't want to see that bill become part of something that gets conference with the Senate. So he's reluctant even on his own creation. Democrats have been a bit more enthusiastic. They introduced their own comprehensive bill in the House a couple of weeks ago, which quite interestingly took all of the Senate bill except for the border title, and it swapped out and used the House Homeland Security bill as their border title. So it's interesting that the bill is Republican in origin. I worked with a number of the Republican staffers on it, but the Democrats seem to have embraced it as an approach they can live with. We'll see where that goes. I just want to do one final footnote, and I wish I had one more slide here. I haven't talked at all about the legal ports of entry, but if we want to talk about cost effectiveness, we do a lot better adding folks at the legal ports than adding, no offense to your guys in green, but adding additional Border Patrol agents at this point. It was a study that my friend Brian Roberts was involved in for the University of Southern California that suggested that every single CBP officer you add at the land ports of entry is worth about $2 million to the U.S. economy in terms of reduced wait times and border crossings and various spin-off economic benefits. Not to mention there are real security gains, because as it gets harder and harder to get through the territory that the chief and his men are patrolling, more people are trying to find their ways through the legal ports of entry, not to mention drugs and other contraband. So that's something that ought to be part of this debate. So I'll stop there, Andrew.
Excellent, Ted. Thank you very much, and thanks for bringing that data to our conference. I'm sure there will be a lot of questions to follow up on all of that. So now, Fernando, tell us what's going on in the local communities, please.
Okay. So first, thank you for the invitation to the organizers to this 10th Annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference. Thanks to Don, Doris, Andrew, Dimitri. I don't know what I'm going to do. How I gonna explain my kids that I'm not there in Halloween trick or treating in El Paso? Thanks to all of you. But I might find some kind of answers. I'm very grateful for the inclusion of this specific panel, because it's very timely talking about border enforcement as a part of this big discussion, especially talking about the U.S.-Mexico border. Let me say that my remarks, my presentation will focus on the misrepresentation of the border region in the national political debate. It's very difficult for me not to talk about politics when there is no a policy debate. We are not having a policy debate. There's a lot of things being said that are impacting whatever is going to come up out of immigration. Also, we'll try to talk briefly about what is the current strategy and the intention of expand it and militarize it even further. But more than anything, I would like to talk about how, from a border community perspective, we can move forward with what I call an effective, focused, and accountable border security strategy. So as we enter into the full national debate on immigration reform, it becomes impossible to ignore how distorted our border has been introduced to the discussion. And I believe that this is not accidental, that there is, and it's important to say it, that this is an intentional political effort to paint paint a picture of mayhem, chaos, and uncontrollable violence in our U.S. border cities. Statements such as car bombings in downtown El Paso, or beheadings and massive killings in Arizona, in the Arizona desert, would be risible if they wouldn't come from the governors of Texas and Arizona, respectively. We need to say that this is part of a political agenda that is willing to sacrifice real border security concerns and the well-being of border residents. But the res- the result of this artificial discussion and this artificial argument about border violence is very concrete and measurable. Today, by any potential measures at the southern border, we have the largest, more expensive law enforcement domestic strategy. As you already said or know, I mean, in thanks to the Migration Policy Institute for releasing that data, in 2012, close to $18 billion were infused to border, to enforcement, and much of that went to the border. And we also know that this amount represents more than the combined budgets of the FBI, DEA, Secret Service, U.S. Marshal, and ATF. But what we have done with that money so far? So we have built more than 500 miles of fencing, triple fencing, and walls along the border. We have doubled the Border Patrol agents, the number of Border Patrol agents in less than a decade, reaching a historic high of 22,000, close to 22,000 Border Patrol agents. We have deployed war drones and unmanned aerial vehicles. We have substantially increased the use of sensors, lights, weapons, and other military paraphernalia. We have deployed the National Guard and Marine units in multiple times. We have implemented, in my opinion, very troubling operations at the border, such as Streamline and Stone Garden, to arrest, detain, and deport immigrant workers. In few words, we have fulfilled every wish and dream presented by nativists and restrictionist politicians in the last round of immigration reform. But guess what? Now they keep saying that this is not enough. And we also need to say that it will never be enough. It will never be enough for certain political agendas because their concerns are neither about border security nor protecting the people. It is about ideology and many times about an irrational attitude towards immigrants and towards our U.S.-Mexico border. And that's precisely where Corker and Hoven Amendment in the Senate bill is about. It's an absurd regression to our intelligence, a miserable attempt to militarize our communities to repeat the mistakes in the past. They are not only telling us that it is not enough, but they are telling me and they are telling us that in El Paso, the safest city in the nation, where my family and my friends live, that we need to construct more fences, deploy more drones, double once again the number of Border Patrol agents, and expand this irrationality. But again, I think it is time to reflect on what we have done and to start moving into a new discussion where we can move from quantity, this approach of quantity, to something that is going to take us to quality of the enforcement. So as I said, our border enforcement strategy is not only the largest, but in my opinion, is the least accountable. The impacts of this strategy are devastating. From a human civil rights perspective, we have close to 500 immigrants dying every day, every year, in our deserts, rivers, and mountains as the intended consequence of border protection. And in the least few years also, we have seen the rise of incidents where border agents, they have used lethal force against immigrants and border residents. So there is a very real sense of fear at the border due to potential mistreatment and abuse. We cannot ignore that. So I believe that it's time to move away from a strategy that considers quantity as the most important element in the question. A massive, slow, ineffective, abusive, and fiscally irresponsible system would only produce bad results. This is not the American way. This is not what our border communities need nor deserve. So it is time to reshape and rebuild our border policies. Our border enforcement strategy needs to reflect our American values with emphasis in the following points. The first one is that we need to ensure that our national security strategy does not treat border residents and immigrant families as a part of the problem, but rather as a part of the solution. We need to hold our border and immigration enforcement institution and personnel accountable to Congress and to border communities. Also, the border and immigration law enforcement institution and personnel must be aligned with the highest of the professionalism and dignity. We need to implement supervising and monitoring mechanisms to ensure that border strategies, programs, and projects are fiscally responsible. We need to promote, encourage, and codify that our immigration enforcement institution and personnels are obliged to respect the human and civil rights of communities and individuals as they are granted by the U.S. Constitution and by international treaties and agreement. And finally, we need to promote the understanding that migration of people to the United States is both a historic fact and that we cannot only address it with an enforcement-only mentality. In El Paso, and let me explain briefly about this. In El Paso, we had started an experiment, a project that I started a few years ago, that instead of blaming the Border Patrol of all of the problems that we were facing at that time, that we considered mistreatment, in that practice that was very common, at least in El Paso a few years ago, where we had illegal entries into property, we have at least alleged civil and human rights violations in terms of wrongful searches and wrongful detentions by Border Patrol agents. We started an engagement process with Border Patrol at the local level in El Paso sector. And we start having a dialogue. I mean, we start talking about the problems. We started talking about the responsibility of Border Patrol to protect the nation, but also to protect our communities at the border. And also they start listening from us, the idea that while they were doing that they couldn't violate this human and civil rights of people. And I can report that through that engagement in El Paso, very specific results occurred. The first one is that we have possibly the only non-uniform community relations officer in El Paso that no other sector has. That has make a difference in terms of how we approach and we relate with Border Patrol. Also, we have reduced the incidence of abuses or potential alleged abuses from 70% in 2000 to less than 20% representing potential abuses by Border Patrol. So we have developed an accountability mechanism, a community accountability mechanism working with Border Patrol to change the practice of abuse, in this case, the practice of civil and human rights at the border. So it is not circumstantial that El Paso is the safest city of the nation, being at the border, because of the trust, because of the relation, because of the dialogue that actually the different stakeholders had in terms of protecting our communities, defending our country, but at the same time protecting our rights. So I believe that as we move forward, we cannot ignore that accountability and oversight and community engagement must be part of our border security strategy. Otherwise, I think we're going to continue repeating the mistakes. The Border Patrol will continue being a very an agency that our communities would be afraid of, and we're not going to achieve the security goals in our borders. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Fernando. So we are now open for questions. We've had three different experts begin this. If you would please come to I guess we can get microphones around. Thank you very much, everybody, for your help. Please identify yourself by name, and if you're with an organization, tell us who you are. I see somebody in the center. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Ellen Campbell with Booz Allen Hamilton. And my question was metrics-based, and it was for both you, Mr. Fisher, and Mr. Alden. How do you measure 90% of something you don't know? And so for you, I was wondering, what sort of metrics are you collecting currently to try and identify what vision we have on the border, how you determine what 90% entails? And I can tell that you've put a great deal of thought into this as well. I'd be interested to hear what you had to say about it.
Thank you very much.
Why don't I start, and then the chief can talk about what they're doing within the Border Patrol. We use basically three different methodologies, and the report goes into a lot of detail. But there's sort of three standard ways you can do it. One is through the use of survey data, which there's quite a bit of. There are two organizations, University of San Diego and Princeton University, which have been doing interviews for years in migrant sending communities in Mexico. And they ask questions about, you know, when was your last border trip? Were you apprehended on your last border trip, et cetera. You can back out of that to come up with reasonable estimates about apprehension rates at the border. A second method relies on the fact that for, I guess, about 12, 13 years now, the Border Patrol has been taking fingerprints of everyone they apprehend. So they have an individual identity for the people they apprehend. And so if that person is arrested again, you know it's the same person. And you know, we know from those records that people do attempt multiple entries. If you do a kind of simple thought experiment, which is you've got 100 people, so you've got 100 people you catch, you send back to Mexico, you make the assumption that every one of those 100 tries again, and you catch 30 of them, then your apprehension rate is 30%, and you know that you've missed 70%. The challenge with that methodology, you don't know how many of those 100 might be deterred, what we call at-the-border deterrence. So they were arrested one time. It was a miserable experience. They got sent back to Mexico, and they gave up. I mean, this is one of the theories for all its problems underlying things like Operation Streamline and the various consequences program. The idea is to raise the costs for individuals as they're apprehended to try to discourage them from trying multiple times, because we know from the records that they try multiple times, to try to raise the deterrence level, which is a good policy goal, makes it a little harder for analytical purposes, because then we've got to try to determine that deterrence level. And then the last line there, which is that green line, is this known flow data, which is collected by the Border Patrol, and they use physical observations to try to make estimates of the number of people they miss. And basically, you see the distance between those two. Something like, you know, recidivist methodology probably gives you a lowball estimate. The apprehension rate is probably higher than that. The known flow methodology probably gives you a high estimate. And, you know, I got to go into more detail on why, but that's probably the kind of grounds. The one real game changer here might be the drones that are being used along the border, because to the extent that they're used, and I don't know in detail the extent to which this is being done, but to do just simple observations over sectors of the border for periods of time, as opposed to being used to target agents to apprehend people, if you're just observing in a particular region, it allows you to get a reasonably good estimate along with these other methodologies of those you're missing. So it's complicated. It's not perfect. The numbers aren't great, but I think going down this road is valuable and will help improve our understanding of what's going on in terms of border apprehensions.
And I would just say, first of all, that's a very insightful question. It was the exact question my staff asked me last year when they said, "Chief, how are we going to do this effectiveness?" And being the chief, I had an answer ready, and I said, "Very carefully." A couple of things, first and foremost. What we're trying to do and what we are going to do is not a scientific method. I want to be very clear about that. We're trying to get more fidelity in the data that we capture. We're trying to institutionalize definitions of turnbacks and gotaways, which, although we've been collecting that data number of years, it wasn't until 2012 that we had a very concerted discussion about data integrity and what it means and building the doctrine. So institutionally, we understood what we were trying to accomplish. Think of it in these terms. When an individual being smuggled comes in between the ports of entry, there are generally three outcomes. One is they're going to be apprehended. Two, for whatever reason, they're going to turn around and return from the country where they came, right? Let's say Mexico in this case, or the southern border. Or three, they're going to evade apprehension. So the whole idea, and it's good to see Rebecca Gambler in the audience too. I've had these discussions with Rebecca with GAO over the last couple of years. And a side note, I joke with Rebecca and her team. I said, "I'm not retiring until I convince GAO that our formula is right." And so when you look at, well, how do you get a percentage? And by the way, that 90%, people talk about 90%. When I testified in Congress, I think it was It was probably maybe in the spring. And I put out the at least 90% effectiveness as a strategic objective, by the way. Because as a strategic objective within our strategy, if you don't set a benchmark, it's useless. And when I was asked, and this is a secret, so all of you folks that are from the media, I'd ask you just to do this for a second. When they said, my staff said, well, Chief, why is it 90%? And I said, because it's an A, right? I mean, so there was no big think tank and, you know, billions of dollars of research. Because when in discussing this with, you know, people like Commissioner Meisner and others, there has been somewhat of a shift, at least from my perspective, of individuals who realize that 100% sealing the border is not achievable. But there are still some folks that say that is, in fact, the end state. That should be the end state. But the vast majority of people that I've talked with over the time coming back to headquarters would reasonably understand that, you know, less than 90% is probably what we should be talking about. So then the discussion is, well, what should it be then? And so as a strategic objective, at a minimum, 90% starts the discussion for people to frame on how you're going to actually capture that. And again, not as a scientific method. So when we have Border Patrol agents now understanding what the definitions are and doing the end of the shift reports, which we have institutionalized to gather the data, to put it all together, and we refine that each and every quarter, is the first process. But then the question is this, and I've been asked this probably at least a dozen times over the past 3 years. Well, that's great, Chief. You know, you've got Border Patrol agents here, but you don't have Border Patrol agents and camera pulls all across the border. So you're talking about effectiveness, and that's great, right? But, you know, how many people entered last night, by the way? And this question is generally posed frequently in the Chiefs and Sheriffs Association. So I'll have a sheriff or a chief of police will ask me this and say, Chief, this effectiveness is great. Love your maps. But, by the way, how many people entered last night that went undetected and got away? And my answer to them is it's probably the same amount of individuals who committed crimes in your jurisdiction that your dispatcher didn't get a 911 call on. You see, so the difference, but the point was we're still responsible as a country to protect that border. So we started thinking over the past couple of years about how do we do that. And see, the fallacy, I believe it's a fallacy, there's a misunderstanding of what security is and what it isn't. There are many people that I've talked to on the border. I'm not saying they're wrong. This is a piece, and especially when you talk about, you know, ranchers in Arizona who for the last 10 years have seen a steady inflow of people coming across their properties. And one of the last visits out in Arizona, and I was explaining the strategic implementation and some of the shifts. And I say, okay, well, look, here's what we're doing. And I had a rancher put up his hand and say, you know, my wife and I just drove that fence along Mexico. It's part of our property line. And we drove 20 miles this past weekend. And we didn't see one Border Patrol agent. And there was no camera towers that were out there that you've deployed. There was no mobile surveillance systems. And we didn't hear one helicopter during that whole afternoon ride. And that border is not secure, Chief. And what are you going to do about it? And so my immediate question was, what did you see? We didn't see anything. So the whole perception about, you know, does a vulnerability exist in the absence of Border Patrol agents and technology? And we posed the question 2 years ago that it doesn't. But how then are we going to cover those areas? Because as discussed, is $48 billion the right dollar amount for this next infusion of more agents and more technology? That discussion will continue. But as we're looking at this, part of, and Mr. Alden mentioned it in terms of the use of the unmanned aerial systems. Right, so the CBP now has 10 Predator Bs within our inventory. Part of the technology that we're using is what's called synthetic aperture radar. It's called the SAR system. Think of it like this. It is a high-speed camera that takes very definitive video. The unmanned aerial system flies at approximately 19,000 feet. It can stay on station approximately 18 to 24 hours. And so what we've done is we've asked the field to identify these areas along the border where they believe, based on intelligence, information from the community, based on agent judgment, that those areas, oh, and by the way, we have a lot of terrain impediments. So if you're looking at these illicit networks that are set up to make money in some of these very inhospitable areas, the least places that they would want to set up this business to do illicit trafficking, give us those targets. And what we've done is we started tracking along the border, and we just started this last March, by the way, so we're in our infancy in trying to do this. And what we'll do is we'll take, let's say, 20 miles, and we'll take that unmanned aerial system, and we'll use a synthetic aperture radar, and it'll do a swath along that border. 24 hours later, it'll do the exact same flight. Same distance, same direction, altitude, 1 degree to give us some variance. And then what will happen is the computers back at the processing, exploitation, and dissemination cell, called a PED cell, the computers will be fed those two images. And at that time, the computers with very sophisticated algorithms will be able to differentiate what's called an anomaly. And when those anomalies are found, it doesn't say, hey, you've got people walking through here, you've got a vehicle that drove through here. It just says there's been some coherent change that has been detected from the first pass to the second pass. And then you have people that have worked their whole careers being able to look at these maps and look at the terrain and to be able to differentiate what that might be. They let us know, and our agents are deployed within 24 hours to get on the ground to confirm or deny what may or may not have happened in terms of that anomaly. And so what happens is now think of that one example repeated since March with 118 different targets that has covered approximately 350 non-contiguous border miles. And so when you look at, well, how do you do that? So the whole idea now is that this was the predecessor in GAO. And really, you know, shined a light on this on one of the panels that we did about 3 years ago, and we were talking about effectiveness. We hadn't figured it out yet, but we thought it was going to be important. It certainly was a lot better than just comparing and contrasting apprehensions from 1 year to the next, by the way. And he said, well, that's really great, Chief. This whole effectiveness is great, but, you know, it's as if you're giving me your batting average, but you're only giving me your hits because all you're talking about is apprehensions. I want to know what the denominator is. I want to know what the total entries are. And as much as I was, you know, I was licking my wounds after that hearing and said, batting average, you know, I was a ball player, but I understood exactly the point. And that helped shape our thinking in terms of we just can't ignore what we think. And I don't think that apprehension is a good proxy for anything. Apprehension is what it is. What's important is how many people, what is the recidivism rate, and what threat do they pose to this country, going back to the biometrics. We're just starting off on this new strategic implementation on how we think about our border, the metrics that we're able to put forward. And I'm not going to be the sole, you know, town crier in terms of saying the border's secure or it's not. What I'm trying to do is set up a fundamental understanding and saying this is what we think it is, at least in our environment, at least within our law enforcement mission set, to change the conversation about whether we should have more people or more things. But effectiveness is going to be a key to that, no doubt. Thank you for the question.
I would like to add one
Please
more thing on the metrics, because I believe that is part of the problem when we focus so much on enforcement that we don't see other potential ideas on how do we define success. And at least from the border community perspective, we don't see other metrics that are important and that people is talking about in our communities. For example, and I think it should be very clear for us that an important metric should be that more people come across legally and less people from between port of entries. I think that at the end of the day, that's going to be the defining metric, and how do we actually approach this issue of bringing the flows in a legal way. The second component of the metric is of the new metric or alternative metrics is how vibrant our economies are at the border. I mean, economic development might be also an important metric. I mean, can you imagine what we can do with $46 billion if that money would go to employment, to education, healthcare? I mean, the border is one of the poorest regions of the country. Less people dying in the deserts, less people dying in the rivers and mountains. I think that is a human metric that we cannot ignore in this equation. Again, less incidence of mistreatment, less abuses of human rights, more training, more accountability. I think those metrics are not being taken into consideration yet into our border strategy.
Andrew, can I just add one thing? I mean, this is why we've got to see this whole context, this whole discussion as part of a comprehensive discussion. I mean, we could make Chief Fisher's job tomorrow really easy. We could just say, everybody who wants to come into the country can come in the country, right? I mean, no more quotas, right? It's open. They're still going to have work to do, right? They still got to keep out serious criminals and terrorists. There's still contraband. But it makes his job a lot easier if we're not enforcing tight quotas. And so to the extent that there are measures in comprehensive immigration reform, for instance, that make it easier for people to come and work in the United States, whether temporarily or permanently, that makes his job easier. You know, you go back to the 1950s, and we looked in a little bit of this history for our report. You know, Border Patrol used to look at things like conditions in the farm economy because they wanted to have a sense of what the demand was going to be. How many people were the Texas landowners going to want to hire, and therefore, how big should the temporary program at the time, the Bracero, be to accommodate that flow? Otherwise, people were going to come illegally. This is all part of a piece. We can't think about enforcing. I mean, not even mentioning employer sanction, all the other stuff we've talked about. But border security does not stand on its own.
So we have a couple of questions. We're going to go one over here, and then we'll come to this side as well.
Thank you very much. My name is Victoria Rietig. I'm with the Migration Policy Institute, and my question is about the image of Border Patrol, and goes to Chief Fisher. So I was struck when you started out by saying, well, what I'm going to say, this is my experience. It's not right. It's not wrong. And it reminded me of other conversations I've had with colleagues of yours, who usually at panels such as this would start out with a bit of an apology or with a bit of saying, well, this is just my story, and we know, because they were kind of expecting to get a bit of fire from the audience and criticism, which you receive a lot of.
Yes.
So my question is about the PR of Border Patrol, because I'm fascinated by the fact that, and this is, you know, based on a lot of discussions I had with colleagues about this, that the narrative about the Border Patrol continues to be so negative in public. And I'm wondering, is that something that you think about in the Border Patrol? Do you think about PR strategies? And do you think that that is the way to go about this? Thank you.
It's a great question. I do think about it. I think, for every bad story that you see in the press, there's probably 10 others that a reporter's not interested in. I mean, to be honest with you, you saw the tunnel seizure probably, you know, this morning. I think it broke on the news, and very little questions about, you know, the multi-tons and the sophistication of these illicit networks and what that means to national security. Nobody wants to do that story, right? But when you look at those other types of media, remember, Border Patrol agents are really no different than many of you in this group, right? At some point along their journey, they decided they wanted a career. And they could have picked any career that they wanted. But yet something drew them into the Border Patrol. When I talk to the Border Patrol agents, they're very dedicated. Now, I will also tell you, it's a very large organization, right? I tell community members a lot of times, you know, we're the good guys. We're not the perfect guys. We do make mistakes. We're the first to admit it. We're the first that are trying to correct it. But from a perception standpoint, Border Patrol agents, after their duties, they live in the same communities. Right, they've got family members in the communities. Nobody wants to come into an organization where they're always being belittled and people don't, you know, support them. But despite that, to the extent that those stories still exist, those Border Patrol agents each and every day continue to put on the uniform, and they have committed themselves to selfless service. You know, unlike perhaps many other professions, they take an oath, and they swear an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And they say, I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion. Well, that's not an administrative process. This is something that they commit to, and we hold them to that standard. And I think when those Border Patrol agents may have a rough day and they go home and there's some news story, and my wife says, geez, how come they're talking about the Border Patrol like that? Doesn't that hurt morale? Sure it does. But I need those Border Patrol agents to understand that we live in a free country, and they're out there supporting and defending that country so that other people can opine and suggest what they think we are or we're not about. But there are fine young men and women who go out each and every day to be able to protect your families against those that would do us harm, and to suggest that this is just about flows of illegal migrants. You know, each and every morning, part of my responsibility is to sit and get the intelligence brief. And it's as true as it was on March 1st, 2003, when Commissioner Bonner first said, you know, there's people that wake up each and every day and think about nothing but to do harm to this country. And in order for them to do that, they have to get here in the first instance. That then was the framework of the mission of U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, Border Protection, and certainly Border Patrol agents understand that. What we try to do, come to forums like this, and just explain our perspective. Right? We're not saying everything is great or the border is secure. There are folks that make those assessments. My responsibility as the chief to those agents is, to the extent that we can, provide a level of information and perspective that perhaps other people don't have the opportunity to see or hear. Because I think with more information, people are then in a better position to decide or make judgments about what is or what is not factual. But I appreciate your question, but it does not dissuade me. If I was going to get into a profession where I wanted people to like me, I wouldn't have chosen law enforcement. Thank you.
If you would go to one of my former students, always get a little privilege here if you've been a former student.
Thank you, Andy. My question is, I'm Daniel Costa with the Economic Policy Institute. I think my question is also sort of directed towards the chief and Ted. There's been a lot of talk today about enforcement at the border and at the worksite, but one of the missing elements has sort of been the feasibility of a functioning, comprehensive entry-exit visa tracking system. Now, we know that around half of unauthorized migrants were here on overstayed visas, and we don't even have a real good estimate on the sort of authorized non-immigrant population in the U.S. And so, you know, the issue, despite that, the issue hasn't gotten really anywhere, even though it's been around since at least the 9/11 commission. So can you maybe talk about the feasibility of it and whether or not you have a sort of internationally comparative perspective on what other countries do in that regard?
Do you want me to take it first? I think this is one of the more poorly understood stories in the comprehensive immigration reform debate, and I actually do blame DHS for this. Not every part of DHS has done as good a job as the Border Patrol has recently in trying to get data out there. DHS has done a lot of work over the last decade to try to develop a functioning exit system. So what we have now, as of 2003, put into place the U.S. visit system, which is for everybody traveling on a visa, and for those coming from visa waiver countries where you don't need a visa. So that's basically everybody except for Canadians and Mexicans. You're fingerprinted when you come into the country and you give passport information and other information. We don't fingerprint you when you leave, but you give all of your information to the airline, so all the passport and other relevant information. That information goes in real time to DHS and is matched up with the entry information. So if you came by air and you left by air, DHS knows that. There's actually pretty good data on that. It hasn't been shared with the Congress yet. DHS has been promising for several years now to give overstay rates country by country. There have been loopholes in that. One of the problems is, say you came to Kennedy Airport and then you drove across the border and flew out of Montreal. Well, we wouldn't have known that, right, because you didn't leave by airport. Well, it's an initiative right now with Canada called the Beyond the Border Initiative, in which the Canadians have agreed to share their entry information with the United States and vice versa. So we'd be able to track that person. We're not there yet with the Mexicans, but I don't think it's impossible that we could get there with the Mexicans. So increasingly, we're doing a pretty good job of this. There, you know, Secretary Napolitano ordered a big kind of scrub of 2 million people that they thought were possible overstays. It turned out a lot of it was data errors of one sort or another. There are a lot of people who come on a tourist visa and then apply for some other visa status. And so these people ended up as sort of possible overstays. Well, it turns out they just changed their visa status and the two systems didn't talk to each other. That's, again, something else that DHS has overcome really within the last year. So now in real time, okay, this person pings as having been here more than the 6 months they were authorized. You can immediately check that against the USCIS database and say, oh, well, they just applied to change their visa status, so they're still here legally. It's been big improvements. Congress is not satisfied with this. Congress wants biometric exit, which may be feasible in the air environment. Nobody's figured out how to do it in the land environment. That is part of the debate going on currently. But there's been a lot of progress in terms of tracking overseas. You know, if you're flagged now, sorry to go on so long, but if you're flagged now as a likely overstay and you leave the country and you try to apply to come back in, that information is at the fingertips of the State Department consular officer who's deciding whether you get your visa reauthorized or not. And it's possible that you've got some legitimate explanation as to why you overstayed the last time. But if you don't, you're not going to get back in. Very final thing, there's one provision I like in the Senate bill. I like it because it was my idea. So, but there's a pilot, actually it's a joint idea with Liam Schwartz, who's a wonderful immigration attorney in AILA. There's a pilot program to give people email alerts when their visa, their terms of entry are about to expire. I think a lot of people misunderstand. They think they've got a 10-year visa, and they think that authorizes them to come to the United States for 10 years. It doesn't. It means, you know, you come and you get whatever term is given to you by the CBP officer, which is, you know, maybe 6 months for a tourist visa. So to ping people when their term is about up, to just kind of proactively say, we expect you to go when you're supposed to, and we're keeping an eye on you. So we'll see where that goes.
Thanks, Ted. Professor Zatz had her hand up, and I just want to make sure I see everybody. Is anybody upstairs trying to raise your hand? Good. We'll get you next, okay? You're going to have to speak loudly. We can't get the mics up there. But Professor Zatz, please.
So if I may, a follow-up on that part is, how is CBIS working? I was involved with CBIS in its early days and haven't been since then. But if I can tag to that, the question I was going to ask to you is, we haven't been talking at all about the interiorization of the border. And that certainly has a major effect on economic competitiveness. You have a lot of cities, including Phoenix, right near the border, that would like to have more of a flexible ability to engage labor and international capital. And yet, for many cities, that thing is a contradiction with the interiorization of really trying to control the border. And I wonder if that's something that you can speak to.
I mean, Fernando, you might, you know, be able to, can you answer that from the perspective of cities in the border region? I answer you quickly on CBIS. I mean, there's a very interesting history there. I think CBIS is a good system. It should have been put in place before 9/11. There was, I think, may well have been a GAO report indicating that DHS is not keeping on top of the system as well as it should be. One of the real challenges in the CBIS system is to make sure that the universities who are taking foreign students are legitimate institutions. There's a real, because getting a visa to the United States is so valuable, there is sort of an inherent incentive for fraud there. If you set up some kind of fly-by-night system, university, you know, sort of university or beauty college or whatever, and you can get foreign students who will come and pay you big money for doing that. They're essentially paying to get the visa to come to the United States. And it's a constant job of monitoring to make sure that the visa-granting institutions are legitimate. It was a huge, huge problem before 9/11. There were 74,000 authorized institutions, and the government had no idea what any of them were doing. I mean, we knew what Harvard was doing, but we didn't know what the Fayetteville Dog Grooming College was doing. And that problem seems to be getting a little bit out of hand again. I don't know the latest, but I'll defer on the city stuff.
No, actually, I was thinking about again those general terms of how the border has become also the interior, but not in the best way possible. I mean, I think there are good things happening up the border. There are good economic projects. There are mobility of people. There's an expansion of communities. But what is in my mind, honestly, in this whole debate is to what degree the interior will become the border, in regards to how militarized we're going to allow this country to be. I mean, when we accept the idea that the only way that we're going to face an economic and social phenomenon is by militarizing a piece of land within the United States, then we set a precedent that then we would allow it later on in the interior, in Chicago and Los Angeles. I think it is true what Dimitri said at the beginning of this conference, that immigration impacts the DNA of a country. But I'm not sure if the discussion that we're having, it is the direction that we want it to go. I mean, we are not only thinking that enforcement is the only solution, or that militarizing something that we didn't do before in America would be the solution, or criminalizing immigrants and criminalizing work and criminalizing flows. Is that the way that our DNA is going to be impacted? I mean, how much we're going to sacrifice our values, our principles. I mean, this idea of what that America is one of the is home of the free, you know, the beacon of freedom and liberty. I think this is at risk, because what is happening with immigration reform is not only what is going to happen with a specific immigrant or with a specific population. It is a definition of what our society will be. I mean, we have a discussion about how we're going to deal with immigration, but later on, how we're going to deal with other issues. And if the way that we're going to deal with immigration is criminalizing immigrants. Even look at the Senate immigration bill. What we have, if we're building a boat, we're going to give undocumented people in the United States, we're going to put them in that boat, in that ship. But whoever is not in that boat, whoever doesn't make it to that boat, is going to be super duper criminalized. And I think that doesn't match with that idea that America can do better. And I think, unfortunately, things are tested at the border before they go into the interior. So if we allow that those drones will be over the border cities as we are, whether it's 10 miles or 50 miles or 100 miles, don't doubt that those drones are going to come to D.C. someday, or to Washington, or to Los Angeles, or to Disneyland, as a matter of fact, you know? So I think we are going into very risky waters in terms of what we're willing to sacrifice at the border and in the interior in terms of enforcement.
I'm going to get to Don in one moment, but we have a gentleman up top, please.
Thank you. My name is Jose Pitti with the USCIS Asylum Division, and I had a question for Chief Fisher. I was wondering what kind of training Border Patrol agents receive to identify persons who are apprehended who may be fleeing their home country after persecution or torture. Not only what the type of training they receive, but how much training they receive, and the percentage of agents who receive that?
Well, the percentage, all Border Patrol agents, you know, either at the academy and certainly in the in their post-academy, when they're actually in the field and processing, will have the standard training. I don't remember the hours, the requirements. And then it goes up from the basic training to those that are pretty much steady state in the supervisory ranks that manage that, to make sure that at intake and during the processing, that every individual that we apprehend is afforded the opportunity during that interview to state those claims. And we work very closely with CIS. And in some cases, in particular, I mentioned Rio Grande Valley before, CIS actually sits in with the detention, our detention folks, along with the ICE ERO, the detention for Homeland Security. And so that's done in an integrated fashion within the department. And that's a model that, if needed in other locations, we're certainly looking to move out to other locations.
Don.
Thank you, Andy. Chief, I wanted to just get back to Fernando's question, which is, you know, and he's talked about the very productive relationship that the Border Network has with the Border Patrol in El Paso, and I know that for a fact there's very good cooperation there. But he uses this word accountability a lot. And so my question is one of the Border Patrol's metrics real engagement with communities, real partnership with them, and real accountability to them? Because after all, I mean, that is where you're operating. You're operating in those communities. I mean, if there's a drone that's recognizing an anomaly, that drone may be over somebody's house, for example, or over somebody's community. So they're very affected by that. And it also seems to me that you really need that kind of community support to be able to do your job. So the question is that part of your thinking when you're thinking about low risk and development of metrics?
Absolutely. And if you've seen our strategy, which was published the summer of 2012, I'll frame it, and you can probably just drill right into that section of the strategy. There was two goals that were set up. Under each of the two goals, there were five objectives. Under goal two, community engagement was one of them. And the reason why we use community engagement, and it wasn't things like, you know, community relations, right? Because part of growing up in the field, you know, we were given training and had to do public relations and go out and do community meetings. And really the way it was set up, to the earlier point, was you got to go and meet with those community members, Chief, because, we think they have some issues with you, and we're going to bring the coffee and the cookies, and we want you to explain to them what you do, and hopefully we'll change their minds in an hour. So I'd go out and, you know, and give them, you know, throw up some maps and answer their questions. And as everybody left, I really wasn't sure if that message was right. So we were looking about community relations. We weren't talking about community engagement. And so what we shifted in terms of our thinking, and more importantly in terms of our implementation, are things like Citizens Academy, right? So over the last few years, what we've done is we've had members of communities in many locations along the border do what's called a Citizens Academy. And we basically do it either a couple of days a week, and we do that maybe for 4 or 5 weeks. We may do it 1 week and then come back 3 weeks. And really, we work with the community and set the itinerary or the program. And what we do is we put them through things like, you know, riding in a Border Patrol agent and seeing what it's like in that environment at night. Give them an opportunity to go out to the range. We talk to them about the use of force model and how we train Border Patrol agents. So the community actually, for a period of time, can look at least through the lenses of Border Patrol agents when they're enforcing the laws, and trying to give them a better understanding of what the agents go through. And so the engagement as a metric is really important. I stated earlier, and I want to kind of foot stomp this, you know, there's going to be a time when someone's going to ask me on the Hill, and if you're picking squares, this is an easy bet. Put a dollar on it, because someone's going to ask me within the next 12 to 18 months, Chief, is the border secure or not? I probably have a piece of answering that question. I think the vast majority, to include the community, is going to have to weigh in. And if I had one chart up here about how we would assess the state of the border at any given time, the last bullet on that slide talks about third-party indicators, which are things like economic development in the area, housing starts along some of those borders, community involvement and interest. Right, because I can set up the best charts and graph and say, hey, I think the border's secure, and yet the chief of police in El Paso says yes, then why is El Paso number 3 in stolen vehicles in the country, and most of those vehicles are going south to those smuggling organizations? It just doesn't jive. And the community, because they live and operate in that environment, we are accountable to them, and they certainly have a much larger voice than perhaps I would in assessing the state of the border. That's what's changing in terms of our strategy.
I'm glad we're talking a lot about effectiveness and measurement. So I just want to follow up a little bit now with Fernando again, because you talked about an effective program of engagement in El Paso. If you were to say what the three major reasons it was successful, or just a couple major reasons why it was successful, what made it successful, and is it something that can be replicated elsewhere, do you think?
It can be replicated. Unfortunately, it's not necessarily been like that in other sectors so far. But I think for that, we needed different factors. I mean, the first one, you need a willing community. I mean, that means that people that overcome fear and then talk to Border Patrol. And I think Border Network was a vehicle for that. I mean, we were organizing communities, and
for
through that community
organizing,
we actually engage. We look for the engagement,
and
we develop that dialogue. You know, so you have a willing community, willing organizations also, and agencies to do that. In the other hand, you needed a chief. Like in that case, you needed somebody that would see the value of community engagement, which is not true in all of the sectors. I mean, to be honest, I mean, we had sectors where they don't see each other at the eye. I mean, they don't sit at the table. The community organizations think that Border Patrol is the problem of all of the problems at the border, mm-hmm. and that the solution is to dissolve the Border Patrol. I just put in an example. And some of the chiefs who said that, you know, those are Looney Tunes groups that just want to put a bad name on Border Patrol, so they don't engage. So mm-hmm. I think the idea that you have a community that is organized and is willing to engage, because they need to engage, and the Border Patrol's chief see that opportunity, I think that was one of the elements that allowed this to happen. And we were hesitant. I mean, Border Patrol told us back then that they were hesitant, that they were not sure to join community forums, for example, and which we did, or just to go through a number of incidents that happened, or just to go back and call them and bring community presentations from Border Patrol to community members, or take the expertise of the nonprofits to the Border Patrol agents while they were in muster trainings, for example. So that was this trial and error process that in the long run was successful. Unfortunately, this is not this is not happening as a part of the standard policy of Border Patrol. Like the relations between communities and Border Patrol chiefs and Border Patrol agents nowadays depends on the willingness of both to engage. So there is not in my opinion, there is not an intentional program, a national program that actually would either facilitate every sector to allow that to happen. I was saying that El Paso is the only, I might be wrong, but I think it's the only non-uniform, this is the only place that has a non-uniform community relations officer. In most of the other sectors, it's a full uniform armed officer, the one that actually engage with community groups and communities. So I think that doesn't allow the engagement process, no, whether it's in Tucson or in San Diego or in the Texas Valley.
Thank you, Fernando. Back to the audience. Yes, Claire.
Hi, I'm Claire Bergeron, Georgetown Law School. I had a question for Chief Fisher. I was curious about the metric of the number of people who are removed each year and the thinking that goes into this removal metric that we hear a lot, which is 400,000 removals, and whether there's any discussion about changing that level of people who are removed and why that level sort of is what it is.
I'm not the expert for ERO operations. I'm going to be upfront with that. But I can tell you when you look at removals, that's a host of a couple of different numbers, right? So these would be individuals who would have gone forward and through an immigration judge would have been ordered removed. These would have been people, for instance, who under the statute we have the authority to do what's called expedited removal. They meet certain criteria. We can go ahead and they admit basically they came in less than 14 days. And so there's some criteria that's set up for that. So when they're removed to the country of origin, that counts. I don't know that there's necessarily a magic number that's set to hit or not. It's just a matter of flow in terms of individuals that are here in this country, whether we apprehend them, their overstays, and a final determination is made generally by an immigration judge to go ahead and effect that removal. I'm not sure if that's exactly your question, but again, I'm not the expert on the policy for it or in terms of I just know what the flow rate is, and as we've started to see the changes in that over the last few years, what is set is basically the funding that ICE ERO, which is the Enforcement Removal Operations, the number of beds and the funding that they're given is finite. So their ability to maintain people in detention is a limiting factor in all of that process from point of entry to final determination on whether they're going to be allowed to remain in the United States or if they were ordered removed from immigration judge. So there is some limited ability for DHS to hold people in detention for the period of final determinations.
We have time for one last question. Gentleman over here. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dan with Stateline. Just a real quick question. You mentioned the shift from Arizona to South Texas and the number or the activity. Can you just give us a quick idea of what's going on there? Why the shift? Is it because is in response to enforcement, or are there some other factors there?
It's a great question. Matter of fact, one of the myths that are out there, and I would ask you to help me dispel this myth, because it's actually happened. Mr. Alden kind of alluded to it in terms of the 20-year trend of what we've seen. El Paso, the shift to San Diego, the shift into Arizona. You've heard of the balloon effect, right? When you squeeze a balloon in one place, it's going to pop out in the other. And that was probably true over the course of the last 20 years. And what I explained to Secretary Napolitano a few years ago, what has changed is the volume in the balloon is a lot less. And so what we're seeing in increases in South Texas is not a result of all of the smuggling organizations that were smuggling for 10 years in Arizona suddenly deciding to go and move over to the Rio Grande Valley and start smuggling there. Now, there's a whole host of reasons for that, not the least of which you've got two different cartels that own the turf there. And so I don't think, unless I've missed a briefing this afternoon, that there's a corporate merger that took place, which is going to make that a little bit easier. And so that is not happening. What we look at, because when you look at, for instance, increase in apprehensions, or even a decrease for that matter, the discussion started 3 years ago. That's generally either a function of an increase in flow, right? So we'll look at increase in apprehensions. The flow is increasing, or we're catching proportionally more people, and the flow has remained the same. What we started to learn over the past 3 years is generally it's a combination of both. And so part of our metric is to try to decide in each one of those locations what is the proportionality in terms of flow versus our effectiveness. And I can tell you in a place like South Texas, although the effectiveness rate is a lot lower than some other places along the southwest border, we are definitely seeing an increase of flow, specifically from countries in this order, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. That's just the raw numbers because of the biometrics. What we're also actually able to capture now and do some analysis on is what we call unique individuals. Matter of fact, it was part of the analysis that when Commissioner Burson in 2011 said, we're going to surge in Arizona and we're going to be successful in Arizona. And Chief, I want you to tell me where the next Arizona is going to be. And we took, among other metrics, but it was the unique individual trend. What we saw across the southwest border, and there wasn't even a close second, the unique individuals, people entering the country for the very first time, were coming into Rio Grande Valley than any other place along the southwest border. And we started looking at demographic shifts and what could happen. And we said, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen there. And so we were a little bit more proactive in this regard and pre-determining where we were going to put technology and border patrol agents. We're still not there yet. But when you look at flows, it's not just, it's an easy calculation. What we decided within the organization, it's a lot more complicated than perhaps we were leading people to believe years ago. But what's also changed is that environment that I talked about at the beginning. So that was part of our thinking and the shift for that.
Yes, yes. To add there that actually that shift of the flows is coming with a cost. The human cost is precisely in Farfurrias when we have like one of the highest rates of migrant deaths at this time this year. So I think it is happening and it is very real. Probably we're going to conclude, but also I would like to say that we have made some progress in with headquarters, especially in talking about the use of lethal force and the protocols that actually been reviewed and released lately. And Anna Hinkins has been also a very good asset in terms of connecting the headquarters with the different groups and communities working on the use of lethal force and other issues. So I think we had made progress, but I think it's too little resources. It is not legislated. It's not in the book yet, but I think we're making progress, and hopefully this will become the standards on how actually we relate in the future.
And if I could just real quickly, Fernando brings up a really good point because it's somewhat timely in terms of the request that CBP made to have PERF and some others take a look at what has been happening over the last year or so. Interestingly enough, of the 80 or 90 recommendations that PERF had put out for CBP, all except two were either already in process or accepted that we're bringing into, whether it's a training environment or building scenarios for the academies. The two, by the way, because I'm often asked this, well, what are the two that CBP didn't agree with? It really had to do with objects that are being thrown at Border Patrol agents and the prohibition that PERF put out that we should not be able to use deadly force. And the other one was shooting at vehicles when really, in effect, our policy doesn't state that. But when you look over and above and you look at that environment, and I'll just leave you with this, you know, if you haven't had an opportunity to go to the border, open invitation, pick your location. I would suggest San Diego in February, perhaps, right? Nice beaches, a horse patrol. Get out there and talk with the men and women of the Border Patrol. Because the fact of the matter is, on average, for the past 5 years, Border Patrol agents are assaulted, on average, every day, almost three times for 5 years. So think of your workspace and your environment. And when you look at the level of assaults against Border Patrol agents in that chaotic environment where those illicit organizations prefer to operate, Border Patrol agents and the use of force as it relates to assaults only use deadly force in less than 0.5%. And so when you look at the environment and the lethality at which these criminal organizations operate, that's the focus of our strategy, is the convergence of those illicit networks and how we can disrupt and dismantle them so they are not exploiting, one, our public safety and security. They're not exploiting people in the manner at which they would do in a place like Farfurrias when they would just go ahead and let people out there in these vast areas to die just because they've already got prepayment, and they turn around and go back and leave these people. And then our mission becomes search and rescue. So, again, thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Well, I always like a panel that doesn't want to stop. This is a great group of experts. I'm giving an A to the audience for the questions, an A to the panelists for their answers, and now you know where Mike got his A for the Senate.
Well, I didn't get it in undergraduate, that's for sure.
But please join me in thanking our panelists. Ted, Mike, and Chief, thanks so much for doing this. And thanks again to all my colleagues at the Migration Policy Institute, Clinic, and the Center for Migration Studies for joining us today. And thank you for being here. See you at the next annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.